So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Dr., no less, Jack Lewis. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
So, Jack, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and tell us a bit about the work that you do?
Yes, so I'm a biologist, really, at core. That was my favourite subject in school. I took it to university to study neuroscience because I thought the brain was the most fascinating aspect of human biology. I then went on to do a PhD at University College London, scanning brains, trying to understand multisensory integration, how all of our senses come together in consciousness. Mm-hmm. And then I went out to Germany to do some postdoctoral research, more brain scanning. And when I came back, by that time, I had become very hacked off with the fact that there was lots and lots of fascinating, relevant and useful information tucked away in the neuroscience literature, mm-hmm. to which only scientists really have access because of all of the sort of technical jargon that's mm-hmm. used to sort of expedite the process of communication in science. So I then sort of decided in 2009, when I came back from Germany, I'm going to make all of these insights available to the widest possible audience. And then spinning off from that, I started a consultancy business called Neuroform, mm-hmm. which is short for Neuroscience Informed Consultancy, mm-hmm. which kind of, you know, so on one side, I do TV and radio and books and stuff for the purpose of the sort of general public. And then consultancy is more getting those same ideas and channeling them in to help people improve their businesses, whether it's, more effective marketing, better strategy, better staff training so that companies can get more out of their employees, all of the above. We all have a brain, every single person on planet Earth. So if you know a lot about neuroscience, then there are an awful lot of ways to help people benefit from it.
Fantastic. Now, you've just written a book called, or recently written a book and had it published called Sort Your Brain Out, which... I've noticed I've just kind of put a typo in there. I called it Sort Your Brain Out, but actually that might be too technical, yeah, in fact, but actually Sort Your Brain Out is the more accurate one. So can you tell us a little bit about it and kind of what's the purpose of the book?
Yeah, so it all dates back to the fact that the first thing I did when I came back from Germany was do a show on Sky One called How to Get What You Want. Uh-huh. And somebody who organises conferences saw that and thought, ooh, this could be interesting as a sort of motivational speaking spot at a conference.
Right.
And it was out at this conference in Tenerife in front of lots and lots of pharmaceutical sales reps. So I was kind of, disseminating this good neuro stuff to help people sell better. Uh-huh. And I met Adrian Webster, my co-author.
Right.
And he was a brilliant motivational speaker, a pre-existing international best-selling business author. So essentially, I wrote chapters and did my best to make it as accessible as possible. It was still a little bit overly technical. And Adrian was my filter, so he discarded bits that he thought were irrelevant to the average business person, which he knows much more about than I do,
right.
With 20 years experience behind him. And then we kind of rewrote it together to make it flow more. He writes in the way that people would usually hear him speak.
Right.
So people have found that you can rattle through this bit, sort your brain out very, very quickly, and that's good. In people are under a lot of time pressure, and they love that sort your brain out can be got through in about six, seven, 8 hours. Quite a lot of people, but in one sitting. And so the aim of Sort Your Brain Out was basically to give people a sort of introduction to their brain. It's the most sophisticated organ in the known universe, and yet it doesn't come with a user guide.
Right.
We all have one sitting in our skulls, and we more or less take it for granted on the whole. We think a lot about maintaining and sorting out our bodies by going down to the gym, but we don't often think that much about things we can do to improve our brain function. So Sort Your Brain Out has a number of different chapters that cover that. Some are general things about how we should exercise for the sake of our brains, not our bodies, because it is the best way to hang on to your marbles in the long term and to be sharp and alert and cognitively quick-witted on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, some of the junk we put into our systems is really bad for quick thinking. other stuff is brilliant for building new brain connections and so forth. And what else? The neuroscience of decision making, described in a manner that can help people, particularly in sales, nudge people towards the decisions that they need.
Right.
Also, creative problem solving. Like there's a lot of very simple things you can do that put the brain into a state where it's maximally efficient in its ability to solve difficult problems. And they're very straightforward, but a lot of this stuff people might have heard of before, but when it's underpinned by, you know, modern neuroscience, like in the last 10 years, you actually find the brain areas involved in these things, it helps in two ways. One, there are lots and lots of good advice out there, and it's very difficult to stay abreast of it all and work out what the most important things are.
Yes.
So by using neuroscience as a sort of lens, it brings certain things into sharp relief, which are very, very important, and the other less important things can kind of fade into the background. And what is the other thing it does?
But let me interrupt you kind of there, because you know I know you're trying to think of all the things that are in the book, but we can come back to that, because what I wanted to go on to was to say that I first came across your work and the reference to the book via an article that you co-authored with Adrian on mycustomer.com called What Can Neuroscience Teach Us About Customer Service? So can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've learned from neuroscience and how it can be applied to customer service or customer experience to make businesses better?
Yeah, no problem at all. So a lot of businesses revolve around getting their customers to make the right decision, being to keep giving them their business, to buy more stock and so forth, to report positively their experiences to other people, to pass on kind of, you know, good reputation. And so because it all boils down to decision-making, the neuroeconomic literature that has cropped up in the last 10 years or so, which is specifically how brains make decisions under a wide variety of different circumstances, has really cast some light on why certain strategies work and why others are less effective.
Right.
So, for instance, the reward pathways of the brain, there's a very sort of overly elaborate names like the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area or the frontal cortex, but, you know, we say reward pathways just for short. Now, these brain areas are involved in experiencing pleasure when you drink, when thirsty, eat when hungry. Those are the kind of original reasons our brains evolved to feel pleasure. But then these same brain areas are also involved in predicting reward. So given three options, product A, B, or C, when you come to scrutinize them and decide, you know, which one you think is the best, it's a signal created in the reward pathway of the brain which helps you make that decision. The greater benefit, the more positive attributes associated with any given option, you get a greater degree of activity in the reward pathway of the brain. And the one which causes the greatest spur is the one which will invariably be chosen. Now, this is really interesting because the reward pathway is often unable to distinguish between activity generated by considering the product and activity generated by other things unrelated to the product in the sales environment. So typically in a bar, for instance, you have loud music, attractive bar staff. All of these things set the reward pathway zinging, which means that we tend to spend more money than we ever intended to when we're in that kind of environment, particularly when you add alcohol into the mix. So the environment can kind of ramp up activity in the reward pathway. And get you that little bit closer to making the purchasing decision.
Right.
Also, the individual, so the salesperson, if you build a rapport with someone as a salesperson, you are effectively boosting activity in the reward pathways of their brain, and then anything you happen to be peddling, any positive attributes of this product, go on top of that. So it sounds crazy, but because the brain evolves in a time where we weren't constantly sort of negotiating and trading, it's slightly inaccurate in how it kind of uses the reward system to figure out, you know, which is the best option, and we're often influenced by things that shouldn't influence us. And awareness of that is very useful for
right.
people in the sales environment.
Okay, and So let me ask you a kind of question. I don't know if this is a neuroscientific thing or a sociological thing or an anthropological thing or a psychological thing or whatever, but I mean, let me ask you the question anyway, and perhaps you can help me sort of decipher this. Well, one of two things, let's say. The first thing is, can neuroscience tell us a bit more about this, the phenomenon that is, you know, we are one way as consumers or customers, but yet when we go to business, we tend to lose perspective on how we would approach things as a customer. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And can neuroscience help us understand why that happens?
Is that a neuroscience question? Well, it's kind of like commuting is another example, like cyclists test car drivers, and car drivers test cyclists. But when your perspective completely changes and you go from your car to your bicycle, your person changes direction. So ultimately people, they find it very difficult to put themselves in two situations simultaneously. So with the mindset of someone selling aware, you lose access to the mindset of the person acquiring, buying the aware. It is really, really good practice to constantly try and play mind experiments where you can put yourself in the opposite situation and to be mindful of it. Because as a neuroscience can actually, it can very much bring something to light here, because our mind state, our brain state, is very much attuned to our environment.
Right.
So when you go into a shop, all of those cues around you, if it's not the shop that you work in, of course, it puts you into the looking for the best deal, or quickly getting the item you're looking for and getting out before you get upsold.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're the person selling the way, when you get in your car and go to work or whatever, when you get there, you're in a completely different mind state, and it's because our brain state is very much kind of yoked to cues in the environment.
Right.
And when you encounter those cues, it puts you in the appropriate mindset. And it's basically, there's so much information in all of our brains that it's a way of filtering and making accessible only the information that's most important to that environment and the behaviors that we execute in those environments.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, because I think it also kind of relates on to my second question, which is, and I think it's related to keys and triggers and things. And so, for example, you know, that there's the idea that you go to a restaurant and you're welcomed by the maitre d' and shown to your table, and the waiter or the waitress kind of comes over and tells you about the menu and the specials and everything else, and it's all great. And then the food comes and it all tastes fantastic. And then you excuse yourself and you go to the bathroom and the bathroom's a mess. And then you completely change kind of what you think about the restaurant, your perception or perspective on the restaurant. And somebody kind of put it in a really good way where they said, we're not an expert in the things that we don't understand, obviously, but an expert in the things that we do. So we don't necessarily understand, we're not an expert in preparing, haute cuisine, but we are an expert in keeping a clean bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore we judge kind of people through things that we understand, not through things that we don't understand.
That's right, but there's also this fact that when you go into a restaurant, people rarely get to see the kitchen. You rarely get to see behind it. There's kind of onstage and then there's backstage.
Yes.
And so on stage, we expect, it boils down to expectation. We have an expectation for how things should be.
Mm-hmm.
And if service, food meets our expectations, then we can be happy with it, we can enjoy it, and we can report positively to anyone who cares to ask how it went.
Mm-hmm.
But then if our expectations are not met, then there's trouble. And from a neuroscience perspective, it's because, going back to the reward pathways, an unexpected surprise, a positive surprise, that is, gives us a disproportionately large response in the reward pathway of the brain.
Right.
And let's say if you could get 1 unit of increase in activity when you're expecting the treat, if it comes out of the blue, then you get maybe a threefold increase instead.
Right. Right.
But if you were to be, if you were to lose out, if you were to make a loss of some description and you're expecting it, of the same degree, you get a minus one unit, a suppression of activity.
Right.
And this is the key point. An unexpected surprise loss or disappointment,
yeah,
of which, if it was expected, would be one unit, instead it would be minus 10 units. Suppression,
right,
of activity. So it's an elaborate way of saying there's lots of neuroscience evidence to suggest that we are extraordinarily loss averse.
Yes.
Because the disappointment of a surprise sort of loss is so much greater than the euphoria associated with a surprise gain.
And is that linked to our survival instinct?
It is. It is. So it basically boils down to what the brain is all about. Ultimately, the latest and greatest all-encompassing theory of brain function is that it's a hypothesis-generating machine, right?
Right.
Whose job it is to create a model of how the world works and minimize surprise.
Right.
Because if something surprising happens where you get a surprise treat, then that means it's great and you feel wonderful, but you could have been missing out on opportunities to get other rewards. If you had a better model of the world and could anticipate it better, you could put yourself in the way of them more often, more frequently, more efficiently. Similarly with losses, if something comes out of the blue and you're unexpectedly let down by a scruffy toilet in the restaurant, to use the example you use, then you need to update your model of how the world works to sort of along the lines of, well, it might look great on stage, but backstage, it's a mess, and here's a tangible piece of evidence suggesting that if the toilet's a diabolical mess, then imagine what's going on in the kitchen.
Yes,
anything could be happening, and you extrapolate forward. So it's the illusion. So the kind of way people present their wares, the way people sell their products, the kind of environment in which they serve their customer, it's a great big illusion. But one obvious piece of evidence that goes against that illusion, and the whole thing is shattered and comes crumbling down. And then you start looking at exactly the same sensory information, the sights, the sounds, the smells, and you scrutinize them more closely. And any time you do that, you're going to see cracks because the air is human, right? So you can't have the perfect sales environment. There's always going to be little things that are amiss. But once someone's believing the illusion that it's a great place, or there's a great food, and you know, you've heard wonderful reviews and so forth, you believe that right up until the point where the illusion shatters. And this again boils down to another aspect of neuroscience that has come to the fore since we've been scanning brains these last 15, 20 years. And that is, I've talked about the reward pathways, but that's just weighing up the benefits. Every time you make a decision, you have to weigh up the benefits in relation to the risks or drawbacks. There's another brain area involved in, well, two brain areas, in fact. One is the anterior insula, which is the brain area involved in generating senses of unease. And in a very extreme degree, then disgust. If you see a rancid piece of food, it's the anterior insula that makes you feel revolted.
Right.
And then there's another brain area called the amygdala, which is all about alarm bells.
Yeah.
So both the insula and the amygdala set alarm bells and unease ringing in your brain when you encounter the scruffy toilet, because your illusion has been shattered, and it's like, well, if the toilet is this dirty, then if the kitchen were as dirty, then that poses a threat to my life and limb, potentially.
Yes. Yes.
And the second something like that happens, it doesn't matter how great the benefits are, it doesn't matter how much activity was generated in the reward pathways of the customer's brain, it's orthanal, because it will be discounted entirely. As soon as the amygdala starts ringing, it's game over. The insula activation, that unease is usually in experiments. It usually kicks in when, having seen the wonderful product, people then see the price tag.
Right.
And the heftier the price tag, the greater the activation in the anterior insula, the greater the sense of unease. And so it's not just about how much activity in the reward pathway, it's also how the activity in the reward pathway is offset by this unease signal in the anterior insula. And it's the balance of those two, which under normal circumstances leads to a decision being made. And then if the amygdala gets involved, if the alarm bells are ringing, then that just sets you back, and you're back at square one. In fact, worse, you're back before square one. It'll take you a while to get right back to sort of a neutral setting.
Well, you've just given huge meaning to the saying, there's no as queer as folk. So let me ask another thing. So what do you think firms, based on these sort of insights, what do you think firms could and should be doing more of so that they can deliver better service and better experiences to their customers?
So the first thing is to declutter.
Right.
There are some things which there's lots of people whose brains are full of guidance from various different sources. And it can get very confusing. We live in a time of information overload.
Uh-huh.
The first thing is to declutter and just work to very basic, simple principles. And one of those involves always deliver and never overpromise, because everything boils down to expectation.
Yeah.
Obviously, to build a good illusion, you need to talk things up. But if you talk it up too much, if there are rave reviews of a film, which is actually good, just all right to good, but all of the critics have said it's brilliant, all of your friends have said it's great, when you go and see that film, you've got no chance.
Yeah.
On the whole, on average, you will come out of a film that's been overhyped feeling disappointed.
Yeah.
And so people should bear that in mind. You obviously got to talk up your product, but if you go too far, then you're finished. Conversely, one thing that people really, I think businesses don't think enough about is to think carefully about not just the positive experiences that their customers have had, but also the negative experiences.
Yeah.
Because if you sell in such a way that you promise to help people avoid the losses and negative experiences they've had in the past, and you show evidence of how you've taken measures to prevent the unpleasant experiences people may have had in the past from happening with you, with your product, with your service, it sounds counterintuitive, but that's actually almost more powerful than bragging about the benefits. You know, so aim to give them the comfort that they won't lose.
Right.
They won't be disappointed.
Yes.
Rather than only concentrating on positives and benefits.
Okay. Fantastic. So, is there anything else that you think that we should be doing? I mean, this stuff doesn't necessarily just apply to how we deal with our customers. It probably also applies to how we deal with each other, you know, in our lives and also within our organizations. I mean, is there anything else that springs to mind that you say, I think people should be doing more of this?
Precisely. You are exactly right. All of these things benefit people, help them think more clearly about what is important, both in the workplace when it comes to delivering good, dazzling customer service, but also in people's social life, in people's personal life, in sport, in all sorts of things. This kind of a sort of brain-centric perspective on life can really help people maximize their own performance by doing very simple things like putting the right fuels in their body, by realizing the importance of sleep, which is just incredibly important for overall brain health, because it's the best time for your brain to do the running repairs,
yep.
To lay down the synapses, which enable you to remember the important events of the day. If you don't sleep, you don't lay down so many connections between brain areas, these synapses, and your memory is not so good. So I, for one, you know, if I have a tricky problem to solve, I not only make sure I sleep on it. Everyone knows sleeping on it is important, but they don't realize that it's because the work your brain does overnight, both in terms of subconscious activity, where only the best bits bubble up into consciousness when your mind is still and quiet,
yeah.
But also the sort of running repairs is incredibly important. Another thing I think companies should do is actually bear in mind what human brains are and aren't capable of. And quite often people are expected to just, you know, perform 110% for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
It's impossible. No brain can do that. And if you're in an emergency situation and you release lots of stress hormone cortisol, then you can just go and go and go, but it will eventually come at a cost.
Yes.
Cortisol is designed to be used in short bursts. Stress has got a bad name because chronic stress is enormously debilitating. It prevents your body from fighting illness. It basically wears you down because it's designed for use in emergency situations to help you deal with the cause of the stress.
Yeah.
But if it's ever present, it has a negative impact on body and brain. So learning how to reduce cortisol levels, laughter is a great way, exercise is another, taking a boring holiday where you're not running around going from kind of event to event, you know, packing as much in on holiday as possible, by really resting and being bored on holiday. It's the best possible way to bring cortisol levels down and to enable your brain and body to repair. But just napping, simple thing like napping. I do it every day. I have a problem, been struggling to crack it. I've done lots of work already, and the solution is still eluding me. 15-minute nap. Kills two birds with one stone. One, it quietens your brain sufficiently for you to dip into what's called the hypnagogic state, which is the most creative state the brain can be in. And B, you wake up a little bit more refreshed.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've been working at something hard, you're going to be running low on energy. And it can be really restorative having that. But most importantly, you set an alarm for 15 minutes later. Don't let yourself nap beyond that. If you've gone to sleep, if you've nodded off with a certain problem in mind, then you're much more likely to wake up with the solution to that problem, because it's the hypnagogic state. It's that sort of subliminal between consciousness and subconscious state, which is where you're basically quietening your brain down enough to tap into the enormous amount of work that's being done under the surface of consciousness, and your mind is quiet enough to spot the little sort of bubble of inspiration coming to the surface. And there's loads of great thinkers through the ages who will attest to this. And the best example of all is Thomas Edison. Like 1,193 patents to his name, invented the electric light bulb, the phonograph, the dynamic movie image capturing device. So basically, there'd be no film industry, music industry, or electric lighting without this man. And he routinely mapped for creativity.
Wow, that's brilliant. So a couple of final questions, Jack, before we wrap up. And so where are you going next with the knowledge and insight you have? Are you going to take on more research, or are you just going to keep looking for areas to apply it?
No, I'm letting the other. There's loads of brilliant neuroscientists all over the world, ever increasing numbers, in fact. And it's hard enough keeping abreast of what they're all doing without doing my own work. So I think it's much more efficient for everyone to work to their strength.
Yeah.
The other neuroscientists are absolutely brilliant experimenters, continue to discover new things. And I continue to read about them and then channel them into people's real life.
Okay.
So that's what I intend to do. I want to do more of the consulting work. I've planned, you know, whether I'm working for multinational PR companies or huge blue chip advertising planning companies working on strategies. A lot of these companies are still, they have a very 20th century way of thinking.
Yes.
And they know that they have to change. They know the world's changed. And particularly with the rise of digital technology, and it's kind of, you know, really created a bit of a seismic shift in how everyone does business. People are actually finally willing in the corporate world to take a fresh look and start from scratch and find a new way of doing things, which is perfect for me because there's lots of people peddling all sorts of snake oil. Mm. But neuroscience is a really good, sturdy foundation upon which to build a more sort of logical, sensible, rational strategy to achieve whatever it is a business is trying to achieve. So, you know, I found uses for this in recruitment, obviously, you know, motivational speaking. I plan to do much more of that, and hopefully the book, Sort Your Brain Out, will enable me to get the attention of HR managers, because I just want to share it. There's lots of fabulous information out there, and I want to share it with the broadest possible audience. I've made a lot of progress sort of 6 TV series over 6 years, reaching a kind of global audience through television.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've been talking in schools, and now I want to work in businesses, and then also eventually the silver pound, because dementia is a major problem, and that's something which, after I've kind of got my business stuff moving nicely and I have more time,
yeah,
I'm going to start helping people understand how to postpone dementia for as long as possible. Because neuroscience has shown us there are many ways. You can't stop it from happening,
yeah,
but you can buy yourself an extra 5 to 10 years with a few simple lifestyle changes. So those are my plans for the future.
Fantastic. And so, although I fear that you may have already done this, but my final question is always this, and that is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
I would love to shamelessly plug my consultancy firm, neuroform.com.
Okay.
N-E-U-R-O, neuro. formed.com. I am but a humble academic. I'm not that clued up about how one market, one sales in a business to business setting. So that's why I agreed to do this, Adrian. I thank you very much for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. Yeah, that's been fascinating and really insightful. And just I'll make sure we get all that linked up and with the book and Neuroformed and everything else, and give it your proper sort of shout out and that. And then once it gets published, we'll share it out and hopefully we'll make some waves.
Magic. That's very, very, very important to you, Adrian. Thanks so much for getting in touch, and all the best.
Yeah, thank you.